this, but we need to...
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
But oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna have
burn to burn too many things we found. That's the great Dart Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the words to that song, except for the one word, Solartopia, which I wrote. I'm Harvey Sluggo Washington, back with you for another hour, a wonderful hour coming up here with a truly great guy. In the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Today is the election day in England, Great Britain, and we have a very, very significant set of choices that the British people are facing with enormous consequences and indicators of where our Earth and where, at least where the Western side of Europe and the United States are headed. There's a guy with us, Alan Minsky. Alan, you with us?
Yeah, I just got the most devastating news of my entire professional political life.
Oh, hear it.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
That sound good.
It's not good.
Oh, okay.
I can't believe what I just saw. They're saying that the Conservatives have gotten 368 seats, a massive majority, and Labor got crushed.
Let's talk about it. We're talking with Alan Minsky. Alan, you want to describe yourself with your credentials and who you are?
Yeah, I actually am gonna have a hard time getting through this, Harvey. This is terrible. I'm Alan Minsky. I'm the Progressive Democrats of America executive director, and so they're saying
What happens. Alan, you've also been the program director of KPFK in Los Angeles. You got me my job with the Solartopia, California Solartopia show, and you are the head of the executive director of one of the great and important organizations in the United States, the Progressive Democrats of America. You've been a political activist your entire life. Your father was one of the great left economists. Is he still with us, your father?
Died in 1996.
Okay, so you have a great pedigree on the left here, and I realize you're a little bit depressed at the moment, so let's jump right into this. This is Election Day in Great Britain, and the conservative Boris Johnson, who looks, talks, apparently thinks, if you can call it thinking, a lot like Donald Trump, has put up a referendum of sorts, I guess, an election on Brexit and so much else. So now let's hear what you're hearing. Let's hear it, Alan. What is your source on the results?
In the UK, they released the results in 1 second, and they have exit polling, and the Conservatives now are going to have twice as many seats in the House of Parliament as Labour. It's going to be the largest Conservative majority since Thatcher.
Wow. And, so what would explain this?
I think I have to leave this and go for a walk while we talk. So sorry, I apologize. I hope this doesn't make for the worst of live radio. This is pretty dramatic news, and it's unbelievably terrible. Of course, what it threatens is the entire Corbyn project. Corbyn's been reduced to 191 seats in Parliament. That's a loss of 71 feet from last time. It is a crushing blow to any hope of Remain. Brexit's over now. You'll have a pretty hard Brexit with Johnson as the architect. And the question is, does the Corbyn project survive?
Does well, what is the Corbyn project exactly?
Please speak up, Harvey.
What is the Corbyn project?
Jeremy Corbyn is the Bernie Sanders of the UK. And he is a very left socialist politician by contemporary standards. And anywhere in the world. And he became the head of the Labour Party in a surprise Labour leadership election after Labour lost significantly, though not this badly, in 2015. And, of course, what we just saw are exit poll results, but they've never been so far off as to be this overwhelming in one direction.
Right. Well, I'm looking here at the New York Times.
Yes.
And it confirms what you're saying here. It says that
it's a Tory landslide.
191, 368 for the Conservatives and 191 for Labour.
Correct.
It would give the Conservatives an 86-seat majority, enough to empower Mr. Johnson to pull Britain out of the bloc at the end of January, as he had promised.
Okay,
well,
so
that is pretty devastating news.
Yes, what accounts for this? Last election... Hold on. Last election, the Labour Party ran against Theresa May, and Brexit was somehow not the major issue. Theresa May was the Prime Minister following the Brexit vote. What had happened was in 2015, David Cameron had won an outright majority for the Tories over Ed Miliband, who was a center-leftist, a little bit marginally more to the left than Blair and Brown, but essentially a continuation of Blair and Brown. And he was defeated when he was expected to win. The government that had, after 13 years of Labour Party, center-left Labour Party rule, from 1997 to 2010, Gordon Brown stood as the Prime Minister. He had never won an election. He was Scottish. He was from Labour. He was always Tony Blair's right-hand person.
Tony Blair was the so-called Labour Prime Minister who got England into the Iraq War and who supported George Bush.
Yes, correct. And
George W. Bush.
But always was elected. Margaret Thatcher had said that Tony Blair's Labour Party was her greatest accomplishment. Much as maybe Ronald Reagan could think that Bill Clinton's Democratic Party was his greatest accomplishment. And anyway, in 2015, after Ed Miliband lost to David Cameron, and what happened in 2010 was Gordon Brown lost, but the Tories were only able to form a government by forming a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And that government was very unpopular for all of its austerity measures that it implemented, and the Liberal Democrats lost incredible credibility for forming a coalition with the Tories. Well, then what happened was that in 2015, Labour was expected to win, but Miliband wasn't particularly personally popular. He actually was the son of a very great socialist theorist by the name of Ralph Miliband. And he was much more conservative than his father, but slightly less conservative than his brother, who was also a potential leader of the party. At any rate, in 2015, they lost, and so Miliband stepped down as the leader of the Labour Party, as someone does when they lose. Tragically, that's what's going to happen to Jeremy Corbyn right now. And Ed Miliband there was a leadership election, and they put up three moderates. When they put up three, excuse me for the sound here, maybe you'd want to talk for a second.
there's a very large helicopter overhead where I am, Harvey, but I'll try to keep talking.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're very used
to these things. This is Los Angeles.
So there was a new leadership election. Everybody expected a moderate to win, and I was in the UK at the time, and they wanted to get a far leftist into the race because traditionally when they had these races, just for sort of a tip of the hat to the old left-wing Labour Party, they would have a leftist in the running. And at the last moment, some moderate Labour people agreed to sign the document that allowed Jeremy Corbyn into the race. And then spectacularly, Corbyn swept the Labour election. And it was a new day for Labour. There was going to be an activist far-left Labour Party in the UK. And instantly, all of the established media just started trashing Corbyn, right, left, left, right, nonstop. Even during the run-up to his victory in the leadership election, Tony Blair, the former PM of England for about a decade, right, more than a decade, he literally said, this is not a moment for trying to persuade your friends against something. This was the time for a rugby tackle. That was his famous quote. You had to tackle Jeremy Corbyn because this would be the death of the Labour Party. And Corbyn was very unpopular and low in the polls, in the general national polls. He was building his activist base within the party. And then Theresa May saw those polls. And what happened in the interim was that the Brexit vote happened in 2016. David Cameron, who had a majority, right, a straight Tory majority in his victory over Miliband, didn't need the Liberal Democrats. He had a majority. He was trying to sort of draw this far-right nationalist base back into the Tory party, and they were demanding a vote on the UK leaving the European Union. And Cameron believed the only way that he could get them to come back into the Tory party was to indulge them with a vote, defeat them soundly. UK would stay in the European Union, as all the establishment people thought would happen. And it would all be good. Well, a wing of his own party was, of course, for leaving the union. That's why the Tory party was split, and he was trying to reunify it. And one person who made a decision, apparently at the very last second, to campaign for leave was Boris Johnson. Almost everybody thought that Johnson, the former mayor of London at that time, the reason he would do that was simply because he saw no way to become leader of the Tory party unless within the Tory party he countered David Cameron. So he did that. And he ran for he supported Brexit, and Brexit astonishingly won. And this was the summer of 2016, so a few months before Trump's election. Actually, it was late spring 2016, around there, and maybe mid 2016. And it was astonishing. And I don't know if you know the backstory, but this Cambridge Analytica played a big role in this. Much as people believe they eventually did in the Trump general election against Hillary Clinton. There was a lot of misinformation and confusion. The vote was 52-48. All the polls had it sort of flipped around at, 53-47, that Remain would win. The establishment was very cocky going into it. Tons of people came out and they voted for Brexit. Now, I'm guessing that's what just happened today. So that's what happened today, is people reaffirmed the Brexit vote. So Corbyn was roundly beaten up in the press, and he's just roundly beaten up in the establishment press at all times for everything. But he was beaten up in the press over Brexit, that he didn't campaign hard enough for Remain. The official position for Labour was Remain. Now, Jeremy Brexit, his whole career, had been very critical of the European Union. So he didn't support Remain. And he, I got to tell you, Harvey, this is a devastating result for the left. For the international left, this is as bad as the rise of Thatcher and Reagan itself, because Jeremy Corbyn had come closer to government in the UK, much closer than Bernie Sanders had, because when Theresa May saw him so low in the polls in the late spring of 2017, she just called a snap election because she could do it. And Corbyn, under attack, there were leadership challenges constantly trying to remove him as the head of Labour. Two of them, I think, one before Brexit, one after. He beat them both back. And they expected him to be slaughtered, like today, in 2017. Well, he ran a great campaign, and Labour's percent of the vote went up by 10% over Miliband. Now, because of the Brexit vote, the Tory party consolidated all the Brexit party vote and the racist UKIP vote. They went up as well. So in the 2017 election, the two big parties got a combined 82% of the vote, whereas in previous elections, they were down, they'd been declining down to about 65%. So unfortunately, Corbyn didn't win with that great boost. In fact, the Tories again beat him. But they were unable to get a majority. So it was a victory for Corbyn without being a victory. And he was safe as Labour leader, and he would be. And he was ahead in the national polls all the way till this past summer, ahead or even with the Tories, both of them at about 40%. But then Theresa May failed to negotiate a Brexit deal that would pass the Houses of Parliament. And that meant that they were still in Europe when the European elections came up. And that ended up being the game changer. At this year's European elections, both the Tories and Labour completely cratered. And what happened since then is the Brexit Party reunited with the Tory Party, forming a coalition that boosted them back up, regaining all that they'd lost as they'd cratered it the summer. And nothing like that occurred with Labour. They didn't get their votes back. And then in some way, in the mainstream media and in the minds of the British people, Jeremy Corbyn became the villain in the whole Brexit saga, which, again, David Cameron called the Brexit vote, not Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn was always a bystander on this. But we really have to look hard and deep at why this result is what it is, why Johnson did as well. Now, Johnson is, by the way, I don't like quoting Bill Maher, but I will here because I'm so addled I can't think of anything better to do. Bill Maher said, and I don't quite see Trump in the same way Bill Maher does, but he says, I once paid $1 million, Bill Maher did, to prevent Mitt Romney from becoming president. Once Donald Trump was president, he said, I would pay $1 million to have Donald Trump be president. David Cameron is terrible. His commitment to austerity is just as full as Boris Johnson's. But Cameron was an establishment politician who you knew what he represented, the same with his right-hand person, George Osborne, who, just like the Blair and Brown people, are now out of power in the Tory party. And as Blair and Brown were pushed out by the Corbyn uprising within Labour. But Boris Johnson is the UK's Donald Trump. And the ways in which he's like Donald Trump, it's even more uncanny than people like who compare him to, you know, Putin himself or to Bolsonaro in Brazil or Modi in India or Erdogan in Turkey. Because Boris Johnson is, yes, a racist, ethno-nationalist, but he is as self-serving as Donald Trump. He signifies the ascendancy of a character to political power that sort of fits this anti-democratic right that is ascendant across the world. Today was the greatest victory for Donald Trump since Donald Trump's own election. And that's the sad truth. We are now fully ensconced in a historical moment where a responsible addressing, and, you know, by the way, the generational divide in the UK is astonishing. People younger than me were overwhelmingly supported Labour. People older than me were supporting Tory at levels that are almost unthinkable. And I think that's going to be one of the clear things that comes out today from the results once we know more of them. Are you with me, Harvey?
I am indeed. It's a very, very depressing situation. I mean, Boris Johnson even looks like Trump.
Yeah, and he—I mean, his level of deceit and mendacity. He is from Eton, and he is from Oxford. Within that caste, people were really talking about upper crust caste here. A little bit like Trump. He had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder that he really wasn't accepted. Now, not at all in the same manner as Trump, who, of course, was from a very, very wealthy, you know, real estate magnate family in New York City.
Well, it's a mob family. Trump is from a mob family. Trump,
in a way.
What nobody says about Trump is that he really represents organized crime. I mean, that's who he is. His father was totally enmeshed with the five families in New York. His grandfather ran a bordello, which is a mob business. Donald, and of course, in the 80s when Trump was bankrupt, but he had all this real estate, he was taken over by the Russian mob. You know, all this stuff about collusion is a vast understatement. Donald Trump was bankrupt in the mid-80s. He owed $4 billion, but he still retained the deeds to all this real estate. So as the Soviet Union was collapsing and these mobsters were coming out of the gulag and making themselves into oligarchs and billionaires, they wanted to move their money into the United States. So how do you move countless rubles, which are worthless in other contexts, into the American economy? You find a bankrupt mobster with real estate, and you do 1,300 or more transactions and launder your rubles into the American economy. And so Donald Trump in the 80s and 90s became the property of the Russian mobster oligarchs. And then in 1999, when Yeltsin takes over and becomes the Russian mob boss, he inherits Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Russian mob, which is headed by Boris Yeltsin. Now, I don't know if Johnson in Russia, I'm sorry, Vladimir Putin, not Boris Yeltsin, I got dated there. Trump, as a mobster, is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the mob boss of Russia, who's Vladimir Putin. Now, I don't know if Boris Johnson in England has the same kind of mob ties, but...
No,
so how did this happen? Go ahead.
No, it's a different thing. Johnson is a buffoon, but he presents himself as a... I loathe the guy, so don't get me wrong. I mean, he's a bigot. He's a misogynist. He's incredibly selfish. But he presents himself as a sort of lovable, chortling buffoon, okay? But he also... is willing so nakedly to advance himself over the interests of anyone else that that's really been the defining feature of his career. He comes out of a very peculiar family background. I think his father was some kind of, I mean, there's some like overseas foreign service type of element going on there. And the family, I think the father was the kind of playboy. So there's a bit of a family estrangement. Apparently Johnson didn't speak for the first 7 or 8 years of his life. So he has that kind of, again, I'm not going to speculate on the what's going on there psychologically when a kid doesn't, who's able later to speak. And so what's been said about Johnson, there's a lot of overcompensatory elements to his character. He was adamant as a child that he wanted to be king. And again, I've read this stuff once or twice, enough to confirm it. It's not idle hearsay, but the public is unclear as to how many kids he has, whether he has four or five by multiple women, has a history of, you know, cheating on his partners, plagiarism as a journalist. He, however, is, and this is, of course, a sharp contrast to Trump, someone who could write a relatively well-reviewed book on Shakespeare. He sees himself and likes to present himself to his core followers as a kind of Winston Churchill-esque character, even to the degree of mimicking some of his, he has a very broad body and mimicking some of Churchill's manners. But he is also tied himself to, he was, by the way, the mayor of London. He followed a socialist as the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. And as winning the mayor of London, which, of course, is the center of finance capital in arguably the world, but it's certainly in the UK and, for the most part, the biggest hub outside of Wall Street in the world, it is a place with a lot of progressive politics. Greater London, which is about 10 million, become the mayor of Greater London. And in some ways, he was relatively progressive. He liked to present himself as ecologically minded, very much an advocate for bicycles and things like that. But he also has always been seen as a person who's going to say whatever he needs to say to advance his own political career. And the move to the sharp right that occurred with him over the past couple of years seems to be now deeply entrenched in his political person. And to say far right, what does that mean in this context? No willingness to defend the social services or that the UK state provides much more generously traditionally than the United States, willing to strip social and public funding for almost all of the apparatus of the British welfare state, not any genuine concern or willingness to go against markets in terms of the environmental crisis, and then to negotiate a Brexit that serves the interest rather nakedly of the financial services that dominate the UK economy that are based in the city as opposed to protecting labor standards or labor rights. So we're going to get a pretty pro-business, pro-finance Brexit. We're going to get him with a massive majority and without any rebellion from the Tory bench anymore against his Brexit plans. He'll be able to negotiate a free trade deal with Donald Trump, which may even lead to the wholesale privatization or large-scale privatization of the National Health Services. But I think there's even worse things to say about this election than all of that. Britain has been a country where something like the Corbyn phenomenon could occur because the North remained soundly Labour and just saturated in a kind of British working class ideology that is something that's been absent here. It's as if the Rust Belt sections of the United States had remained firmly left Labour all these years. I think that was broken today. And I really hate to speculate as to why it was broken, but I do, if I were to do that, I think it would have to do with the internationalism of Jeremy Corbyn, the multiculturalism of the Corbyn movement, and the very reactionary, racist tendencies that informed the pro-Brexit vote in many of the northern, traditionally Labour constituencies that apparently voted heavily for the Tories today. In other words, there was a rejection of Corbyn's pacifism, left internationalism, multiculturalism, and it begins even though he's very far left of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the kind of racist rejection that somehow is combined with an anti-elitism, because in the north of England, they view the south of England as being elite and looking down on the working class north. And Corbyn, who does come from North London, in his embrace of a multicultural racism, it seems to me he's being rejected by a what is in effect a white nationalist backlash.
We're talking with Alan Minsky. Since we're in Los Angeles, there are airplanes and helicopters flying over constantly. It's the price you pay for not going deep into a studio, but there we go. We're talking about the very depressing and dangerous outcome of the today's election in Great Britain. I was just reading before we went on the air how Elizabeth Warren has started to attack the moderates, so-called moderates, the corporate Democrats, who are arguing that we have to go find those three or four Republicans who might be come over to the Democrats. What happened? You mentioned, I mean, in the United States, in the upcoming election, which is a year away, or now 11 months, it is very clear to me, and I think anyone who follows the election with a clear eye, that the only way to defeat Donald Trump is to bring out the millennials. We have 86 million millennials in this country. There is virtually nobody left in the middle. It's the mythological middle. And so the Bidens and Buttigiegs and Klobuchars people are aiming for some kind of moderate, I guess, Bloomberg, sort of Republican light, non-progressive Democratic alternative to Donald Trump, are seeking swing voters that don't exist. And the only victory, and this, of course, Barack Obama did this pre-millennial voting, but before they were old enough to vote, is he went after the young people, and it was, you know, through the internet, and it was a youthful vote that won Obama, however conservative he turned out to be, in 2008 and 2012. And in 2016, Hillary Clinton totally turned off that demographic, called us all deplorables, and ran a completely charisma-free campaign with a vice president who was anti-choice, whose name nobody remembers except me. It was Tim Kaine from Virginia. And now, with Biden, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Booker, et cetera, you know, we're getting another middle-of-the-road, mythological middle attempt here that is clearly going to lose to Donald Trump. So Elizabeth Warren came out today pretty much throwing her lot in with the Bernie Sanders wing of the party and saying, look, you know, you guys, we have to stand for real social change. But this is obviously, this vote in England is going to have repercussions here as well.
I hope not. I don't know that people follow it too closely. I hope that's not the case. AOC.
Well, I hope you're right.
And Greta Thunberg effectively endorsed Jeremy Corbyn today. Bernie actually went to the UK in 2017 and supported him. Of course, we're going to see the real results coming in. I mean, there is a sliver of a chance that these are dramatically wrong exit polls.
Well, exit polls are generally pretty accurate. I mean, I have to say, having studied election theft in excruciating detail since 2004, you know, we have repeatedly turned to exit polling to show how the real, the legal results are at variance with how the public really voted, and that the exit polls are actually a more accurate reflection of the voters' will than the actual outcomes, which are warped by the stripping of the voter rolls and the flipping of the electronic vote counts. So
there's none of that in the UK. It's paper ballot, and both parties which have significant apparatuses go out. Go ahead.
What would explain this? I mean, why would the British electorate turn in this direction?
It's tough. I mean, especially what's shocking is the wholesale and free fall of... You have to remember, Boris Johnson was someone who just a few weeks ago, 2 months ago, had a rebellion in his own party. He lost his majority, which basically forced the election. He broke ranks with the small Northern Irish party that was providing Theresa May with a working government, working majority for her government. It was a two-party coalition of a small Northern Irish, very right-wing, English nationalist party inside Northern Ireland provided Theresa May with her majority. And, you know, Theresa May was somebody who had voted Remain, like David Cameron. There was a lot of resentment among the Brexiteers towards Theresa May. So, in that sense, Theresa May was less of a pro-Brexit Tory leader in the last general election. Everybody knew the blaming of Corbyn occurred around Brexit, and the blame was grounded in, the logic of blaming him was that he was soft on Brexit. He really was a lever. And Jeremy had been at times throughout his long political career what was called a Lexiteer, a left Brexit person. Now, the party was a Remain party. Corbyn was in a very difficult bind
around the issue of Brexit. Let me explain pretty simply. As complex as Brexit is, this is pretty simple. If you take all the people who voted for Labour, and then how did they vote in the Brexit referendum, two-thirds of them voted Remain. The constituencies that Labour held, right, there's 230 to 260-odd seats across the country before this election, two-thirds of those voted Leave. So that's a political double bind. How is he going to negotiate that? And I suppose the first order of explanation around this result is this. He was able to skate on the issue of Brexit, skate by, as it were, because in the 2017 general election against Theresa May, because there was no way in which the Brexit people were going to hold him to blame, because he was actually more philosophically pro-Brexit than Theresa May. In this election, you had one of the two lead national campaigners for Brexit running against Corbyn. And Corbyn finally clarified the Labour Party Brexit policy about, well, just at the beginning of this election cycle. And what he declared was that if he was elected prime minister in this election, he would negotiate a new deal, which would be a very pro-worker, pro-environment trade relationship with the EU, modeled after Norway's relationship with the EU, because Norway is not a part of the EU. He would then take that negotiated deal, once it passed Parliament, put it up to a vote. Or no, I don't think it even passed Parliament. Once he negotiated that deal with the EU, he signed it, the EU signed it, before Parliament voted on it, and he would take it to a popular vote, which would give Remain an option to win. Remain is done now. Brexit is a reality. And Brexit will be negotiated by Boris Johnson, and it will be passed by the Tories. I don't know if Brexit really is a majority position held by the British population. It seems really razor close. But now that is finally off the table. But I think that's a big part of the dynamic. The other major part of the dynamic is the nonstop bashing of Jeremy Corbyn that has occurred over the past 4 years since he became a major player on the national stage. It's been unrelenting. It's beyond anything if people think Bernie's treated badly in the American media. It's orders of magnitude way beyond that. In fact, it's very analogous to how Donald Trump is treated on TV talk shows like, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel and shows like that.
Right.
He is the source of a sort of unending cascade of contempt in the national media.
All right, so let's move, Alan Minsky. We'll see how this all shakes out, and we'll have you back to talk about it once we know more. Let's talk now about the United States and your fantastic organization, the Progressive Democrats of America. You've done me the honor of reading most of my history of the United States, which I appreciate,
which puts
in perspective what's happening here in this country during the Trumpocalypse and the brain-dead period of inaugurated by Bill Clinton and his sale of the Democratic Party to the corporations. I mean, if ever there was an argument to be made that we have a single-party system, it certainly began in 1992 with Bill Clinton's complete capitulation to the corporate mainstream of the banking community. Goldman Sachs, Robert Rubin, clearly ran the Clinton administration. There are zero, well, really in this country, except for Obamacare and a brief moment with the stimulus package, there has been no permanent social programs enacted to help the working middle class since Vietnam. And really, Carter left us no legacy. Reagan destroyed whatever came before, and then followed by the nothingness of Bill Clinton, the horrors of George W. Bush, the stylish dance of Barack Obama, who used the 2008 economic crisis to bail out the banks, but not working Americans,
did do the ACA, that's it. Then now, of course, the catastrophe of Donald Trump. So you are the executive director of the fabulous Progressive Democrats of America. What role is your group playing, and where do you see us going here in the United States?
Well, you know, PDA is political formation that was begun in 2004. It's not a political party. It has three different operating organizations that are under the same umbrella. And one is a national lobbying group. One's a state and local lobbying group that's structured to have mass member chapters across the country. And the third part of the organization is a federal PAC that endorses candidates and supports candidates as an independent PAC. So we're really allowed to advocate as we like, not as in coordination with the campaigns directly. And there's structured ways that we can raise money for those campaigns and contribute it directly to the campaigns through our mass membership. And that's how we operate. We endorse candidates through the federal PAC and through local PACs around the country. Like in California, we have one, PDACA. That's PDA California, or PDACA. And, so we are an organization that is unapologetically progressive, left progressive. We support public policy positions that address the environmental crisis, structural racism in the United States, wealth inequality, the weakening of labor unions, try to address structural racism however we can through public policy as well. Structural sexism as well, certainly supporting all LGBTQ rights. Just across the board supporting progressive legislation, progressive public policy, and trying to bring the United States back to being a broadly middle-class society where there's generalized prosperity, where we're responsible stewards of the earth, again, trying to overcome the huge, massive structural imbalances that have been endemic to the society since Columbus arrived with his ships in 1492. And so, how do I see things going forward here? Trying to shake off the UK election results as I think about it. Obviously, we were the PAC that drafted Bernie Sanders to run for president. We have endorsed Bernie Sanders for president in 2020. We endorsed him in 2016. Again, we were the first organization nationally to begin what was called the Run Bernie Run campaign. We launched that in 2013.
You personally were a part of that. You were personally part of the decision, Bernie's decision to run for president.
PDA was. I was not, though I was a PDA activist by that point. And so, we're looking for a transformation, a structural transformation of the sort of rules and parameters of American society and economy in a pretty significant way. We certainly don't want any less of a prosperous society. We recognize that, technological industrial societies are very complex. There's been such a massive amount of cultural and social dislocation over the last century around the transformations in the way humans live. We're not looking to make any changes that undermine that. In fact, we pretty much want that level of prosperity that is available to what's left of the American middle class, available to the general population, and also to do so in a way, however, that is fully responsible in terms of environmental stewardship. We do believe that the transformation of the energy system away from being fossil fuel-based to renewable, sustainable energy, along with the necessary work of effective carbon sequestration, and planting trees, for instance, will be a very important project for humanity to undertake writ large. But we do believe that that kind of transformation is actually could be an incredible boon to the economy, producing all sorts of new industries and innovation that would not in any way undermine American prosperity and global prosperity, but be a big boost to it. On all those fronts, that's what we represent. And
we do think Bernie Sanders is a hell of a politician. We do have very good relationships with, historically, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and I can't speak for our rank and file. We've made an official endorsement for PDA, but certainly a number of PDA activists across the country are personally very close to Senator Warren as well, and she's my strong second choice, but I have a very, very strong first choice in Bernie Sanders. And so how does it look going forward for us? You know, fortunately, I don't think foreign politics really make that much of an impact on U.S. politics. I think that Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders are very different characters, too, very different in their personality traits and character. Bernie is, famously brusque, very direct, high-volume speaker, very pointed, who speaks almost in Frank Luntz, the horrid right-wing guru and pollster, who's considered one of the masters of the composition of Republican talking points, would certainly recognize that Bernie Sanders is a contemporary, modern, whatever, postmodern 21st century politician from heaven in terms of his capacity to take very complex ideas and to articulate them succinctly in very few words. Bernie also has a real sort of joie de vivre about him that has been absent from the Jeremy Corbyn's own personal sort of presentation of himself.
Corbyn, after all, is British, so we don't expect much joie de vivre. I think it's the weather over there. We're talking with Alan Minsky, the great head executive director of the Progressive Democrats of America. How do people get a hold of you and the PDA organization, Alan?
PDAamerica.org is our website. You can find us on Facebook as Progressive Democrats of America. You can find us on Twitter. Anybody's welcome to email me at Alan, A-L-A-N, at PDAmerica.org. That's PDAmerica.org. And that's our website, PDAmerica.org. We have chapters all over the country. And we are, a mass membership organization under the portion of our organization. Again, there are three parts to it. Under the 501c4 heading, we have chapters all over the country. And we, again, are involved in lobbying our... Mm-hmm, go ahead.
How many members do you estimate PDA has?
Well, we have members and supporters, and sometimes we call them activists, people who are directly involved in PDA chapter organizing and activism, many thousand are, if you want to take our largest number, we probably add up to about 500,000, 600,000 on our email lists. So it's a pretty big organization. We are partners with we have an official partnership with an even larger organization, which is Our Revolution, which has, I think, an email list in the 5 million range. And then we have a great partnership with the National Nurses United, NNU. And then we have other non-official partners who we just work with constantly, from Public Citizen to Social Security Works, on down the line, many unions. And one of our wings, People Demanding Action, we have three wings. We call ourselves Progressive Democrats of America, but the other two also have the initials PDA, so people don't get confused and think we're not related. And People Demanding Action, which is overseen by the great Virginia-based activist Andrea Miller, is an organization that is really focused upon concerns of communities of color. And just to give an example, Andrea was and People Demanding Action were one of the great heroes of the drive to organize African-American voters, in particular African-American women voters in Alabama, that led to the victory of Doug Jones in that special off-year election. So, we're a big organization. And we have been very upbeat about the prospects of left progressives in a political environment in which the center is collapsing and the left has been rising and the right has been rising. But you're talking to me today, Harvey, on a rough day for the national
left. That's okay.
Left.
So, let's keep on the American left here. First again, I want to again offer you my book, The People's Spiral of U.S. History, for fundraising purposes for any and all of your organizations, and I'm sure we can come to some kind of a deal that we can get this book out there and have it benefit you. It is a history of the whole United States,
basically unlike any that's been done since Howard Zinn, which is exactly 40 years ago. And I like to say it's Zinn's People's History on Acid. So hopefully it'll be of use to you. And I know your work. I know your organization. You're going to be glad to hear that last Friday I went to the party, the annual gathering in Washington, D.C. of another organization that has been committed to environmental protection for decades and is still in very good shape, doing great work with great leadership, and that's Greenpeace. Greenpeace, I became a senior advisor to Greenpeace in 1991, and I'm now a voting member. I believe I've been with the organization as long as anybody, and you, I do have the distinction of having the most children of any voting member, which is five. You know, our institutions on the left, or I don't want to call them institutions, our living organisms on the left do have longevity, and I know PDA has been around for a while, and I'm very, very happy. It was a difficult process for you transitioning, still holding your space at KPFK Pacifica. I heard you doing fundraising pitches as well, long ago as yesterday. I'm glad you're yeah. still there. But your leadership at PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, has been absolutely essential. I know it's just been really hard on you personally, physically, psychologically, to handle both positions. But PDA is an essential organization with a very, very powerful clout. As you say, you've got tens of thousands of people involved. You're involved with our revolution, which is up in the half million range. And maybe you ought to talk to Annie Leonard at Greenpeace.
Our revolution is up around the 5 million range.
5 million, I'm sorry. Slight order of magnitude discrepancy there. But, you know, and I'm going to repeat that what's going to decide the 2020 election, which could have decided the 2016 election, had the nominee been someone other than Hillary Clinton, will be the millennials. And I assume that your demographic at PDA and our revolution is deeply rooted in the this upcoming millennial generation of people born between the early 80s and the early 2000s, who number in the range of 85 million people. I mean, that's where it's at for the future of this country and the future of this world. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, it's, well, I mean, you know, what's happened? I'm baffled, you know. I know you, and I love you, and I love so many great progressive baby boomers. But, you know, it just seems that what has occurred in both the UK and the United States is just devastating in that, you know, if you go back to the 1980s and the unraveling of the post-World War II social contracts, you know, high union density, and you had pension funds that were massive. And then you know, like those things carried over in 501c, what are those called, the retirement funds? I'm going to get the numbers wrong.
KEO.
And they were carried over through the 80s into the 90s. Now they're a fiction. You know, you talk to kids today, they never heard of such a thing. And I think what's happening right now, and this happened in the UK too, is that people are voting so conservative the older they get because their retirement packages are reliant upon a buoyant stock market. And they're basically voting on that issue, and to hell with the future. And kids today are looking out on it, and they're just like, this is barren. I mean, the economic realities that you grew up in and I grew up in as a Gen Xer, they're fictional to kids. They see environmental devastation. They see it's almost impossible to make ends meet in any of the so-called prosperous metropolitan areas with a basic job. It's impossible anywhere in this country to make ends meet with two basic jobs in a household with children. And so they recognize something really, really has to change. They see the connection between the environmental crisis and the economic dead end that they're living. And yet they're being crushed electorally by older folks who are voting for their pensions, which.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and, of course, the pensions have been ravaged by organized crime. This movie, which is incredibly boring, The Irishman, talks about Jimmy Hoffa and only briefly, tangentially mentions the pension funds and the ravaging. Well, actually, the pension funds are central to part of the plot, but they don't talk about how they've been ravaged by the mobsters and, led by Donald Trump, who is a mobster. And you're 100% right about the baby boom being dependent on a stock market that can support those pension funds that haven't been totally ravaged by the corporations. And you have to fault, the mobster wing of the organized labor, whose corrupt leaders like Jimmy Hoffa did participate and have participated in the looting of these pension funds. And it's a very big problem. And one of the reasons for a decline in labor is that you did have this mobster element that did compromise this stash of cash. We're now seeing this, of course, in California with the demise, the bankruptcy of PG&E, which is also bound up in various forms of pension funds and other investments. The California Teachers Funds, two of them, are deeply invested in PG&E. And we're gonna have to see what happens soon. Actually, tomorrow the governor is gonna make some kind of decision about the future of PG&E, and it too. I mean, we're looking at it is very precarious. We're looking at a really barren economic future for my generation, and a dicey one for yours as well. We're talking with Alan Minsky, the great executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, which is an incredibly important group. And, with this election in Great Britain, we'll have to sort it out. But we are seeing in the Democratic Party, I think very significantly today, Elizabeth Warren has thrown in her lot with the left, with the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party. And, they keep talking about Biden as a front runner, but if you add Bernie and Elizabeth Warren together, they dwarf him. And, Joe Biden is the death of the Democratic Party and the death of American democracy. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Pete Buttigieg is right behind him. And we're going to see a real bifurcation. Alan, a pleasure to have you. An honor. We'll be back again next week, hopefully with better news.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Thank you.
Thank you, crew in New York. Thank you, listeners. We're back next week with Solartopia and the green power.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're